President Hyde, ladies and gentlemen. When I am introduced, as I frequently am, at some length, I am reminded of the late F.E. Smith, Lord Birkenhead, who, when he was Chancellor of Britain, went up to the north of England to give an address. And the person introducing him spoke for 45 minutes and concluded with the words, "Here is Lord Birkenhead, who has come to give you his address." And Birkenhead said, got up and said, "47 Cadogan Gardens, London, SW1. And promptly left. On the subject of the same Lord Birkenhead, and this is a way of introducing my talk this evening, perhaps, some of you may know that the most exclusive club in London, a bastion of male liberty and elitism, is the Athenaeum. Lord Birkenhead was not a member, but on his way to the law courts, he was in the habit of stopping off there and visiting the men's room daily. The members, not unnaturally, found this somewhat upsetting to their amour propre, or dignity. So the club secretary was approached and was asked to accost Birkenhead the next time he took such extraordinary liberties with the premises. So, sure enough, the following morning, F.E. Smith, Birkenhead, on his way to the law courts, popped into the Athenaeum, into the men's room, came outside, and the secretary said, "Excuse me, Lord Birkenhead, are you a member of this club?" And Birkenhead said, "Good God, do you mean there's a club as well?" The reason I brought that story in, actually, is that I have been travelling rather rapidly, rather breathtakingly, in fact, around the United States. As President Howard said, I think I left Spain last Sunday, and I rather think I got to Portland on Monday, San Francisco on Wednesday, and Chicago yesterday. And it suddenly occurs to me on these trips, good God, do I have to lecture as well? the ardors of travel seem sufficient without having, so to speak, to sing for one supper. I am, however, very deeply grateful to you all for inviting me here this evening. What I want to talk about tonight doesn't really have a particular application to the realm of economics, but it does have, I hope, as it develops, an application in a very wide sense to the total state of our society today. I'm going to deal primarily with the field of literature, which is the field I'm particularly interested in, but I very much hope that even if I don't make the obvious deductions, that you will be able to make them for yourselves. In 1966, which is 8 years ago now, I delivered what I rather naively assumed to be an innocuous little lecture entitled Trousered Apes to a group of American university teachers of literature. On that occasion, having quoted two extracts, one from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice and the other from John Osborne's play Look Back in Anger, and also having admitted that Osborne's play is anything but the ultimate in modernity, it is in fact mild and old-fashioned compared with the works of William Burroughs or Edward Albee or a host of other contemporary authors, I concluded my lecture as follows. Air pollution and water pollution are now quantitatively measurable facts of life. But is it not possible that the psychological poison is also at work in our society, destroying men's minds and moral fiber, leading them back to the primitive jungle from whence they came, before that same jungle, devoid alike of civilized men and trousered apes, returns to its pristine uninhabited state, the only real victor after all? Now, as I should have expected, but didn't, these words unleashed a furious discussion and controversy, lasting well into the night and continuing the following day. Now, much of the criticism, it seemed to me, appeared to be based on a misunderstanding of what I was trying to say. One critical colleague assumed, for reasons best known to himself and the deity, that I wanted to revert to 18th century methods of plumbing. Another young woman of advanced liberal views shouted, "You're advocating censorship. You shouldn't be allowed to publish it." I accordingly decided to expand it to book length. And the result was rejected by 26 of the leading publishers in the United States and the United Kingdom, exercising presumably their own type of censorship. The replies, incidentally, were most revealing. One publisher wrote back saying it was too good for his list. Another wrote saying that it was too frivolous and too specialized. I don't, on the whole, believe in replying to publishers, because not many of them can read. But on this occasion, I did take the liberty of writing back to the effect that it was about as amusing as the Book of Job, and that since it dealt with literature, psychology, history, theology, and philosophy, it could hardly be described as merely anything. Eventually, however, a discerning little publishing house in London, which Mr. Shenfield knows of, the Churchill Press, brought it out. And here again, it was very interesting, because a very old and valued friend of mine, and I see no reason to withhold his name, Malcolm Muggeridge, wrote a very long and laudable piece concerning it for the London Observer, that bastion of civil liberties and liberalism. He showed me the reply from the editor. "Dear Malcolm," it went, "for 40 years or something, I've forgotten the exact number of years, we have published everything you have written. We will make an exception in this case. I do not want to see this book receive any publicity whatsoever." Now, this is not a form of liberalism, I think you would agree, and I think it's time we stopped calling it liberalism. It is totally illiberal of any viewpoint which opposes its own. Returning, however, to the main subject for the moment, nothing that has happened on the national or the international scene since I delivered the lecture has changed my opinion that the Western world and its culture are currently saturated with violence and animalism. No one who reads a newspaper or watches a television news program or who reads an avant-garde novel can doubt the truth of this statement. But few seem aware of the underlying causes of this phenomenon. In order to understand the true nature of the chronic upheaval which is engulfing our culture and indeed our entire civilization, we must look into the past and attempt to trace its genesis there, for the present is simply an outgrowth of what has gone before. Concluding the Gifford Lectures at Edinburgh in 1947, the historian Christopher Dawson declared, "The recovery of moral control and the return to spiritual order have now become the indispensable conditions of human survival." I would like to repeat that, if I may. The recovery of moral control and the return to spiritual order have now become the indispensable conditions of human survival. Believing, as I do profoundly, that the arts in general, and I'm talking now not just about books, I'm talking about movies, I'm talking about television programs, I'm talking about all the artifacts by which and through which an age expresses itself. I do not believe that these arts are merely a mirror reflecting social and cultural values. They are, I fervently believe, powerful forces which shape and mold the way in which people live and behave. This view, incidentally, has been held by every major critic from Plato to T.S. Eliot. Now, in my book, I examined contemporary literature, drama, music, painting, and those two powerful molders, the cinema and television. In all these various manifestations of the contemporary scene, one finds not only an absence of moral control and spiritual order, but in most instances a deep and overt hostility to any such restraining concepts. Morality, however, always involves a sentiment of submission, because it demands the recognition of an authoritative norm, be it religious or secular, external, as in former times, or internal, that is to say, self-imposed. The very terms submission and authoritative appear to be anathemas to an age intoxicated with the concept of freedom. But true liberty is surely not so much external as internal. It demands, among other things, self-control and a punctilious fulfillment of one's obligation. I think perhaps those are the two most abused terms of the 20th century, liberty and freedom. The kind of freedom I'm talking about, I suppose, is the kind of freedom that comes from the satisfaction of meeting one's obligations, of living socially in harmony with one's fellow human beings. It is significant, I think, that one of the great theologians of the 20th century, Bonhoeffer, when he was in his execution cell in 1944, facing certain death at the hands of the Nazis, could still write in his diary, "I now know complete and total freedom." That sort of freedom I'm talking about. It's an internal thing. It resides in the human soul, resides in the human mind. It has nothing to do with what Peter Ustinov once described freedom in the United States as being able to, one definition of American freedom is sitting out on the front porch in your pajamas, drinking a can of beer and shouting, "Where else can you do this?" As Edmund Burke wrote in 1791, men are qualified for civil liberty in exact proportion to their disposition to put moral chains upon their own appetites. Society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon will and appetite be placed somewhere, and the less of it there is within, the more there is without. It is ordained in the eternal constitution of things that men of intemperate minds cannot be free. Their passions forge their fetters. Controlling will upon power and appetite be placed somewhere. And the less of it there is within, the more there is without. There is a message in that, I think, for all people living in a free society. You can call it, if you like, enlightened capitalism, if you wish. Unless a people and individuals have a measure of self-control, then the control will be exercised from without. Now, no doubt, contemporary writers and artists would assert that violence dramatizes the situation, and that living in a violent world, it would be intellectually and socially dishonest to depict life in any other way. If, however, in the novels which he reads, in the plays and films which he sees, and in the philosophical and ethical treaties which are presented for his edification, Western man is continually and exclusively presented with an image of himself as a being violent, animalistic, alienated, mannerless and uncivilized, then is he not being encouraged, indeed almost forced, to identify with such an image and to mold his own outlook and behavior to conform with such an image? In 1869, Matthew Arnold defined culture as being a pursuit of our total perfection by means of getting to know, on all the matters which concern us, the best that has been thought and said in the world. Even the most charitable critic would find it difficult to reconcile Anthony Burgess's Clockwork Orange or a play by Harold Pinter, for example, with this definition. And one may be pardoned for assuming that the worst that has been thought and said has supplanted the Arnoldian ideal and become the contemporary cultural or anti-cultural norm. Now, lest I be accused of indulging in unsupported generalizations, perhaps I ought to be a little more specific, even at the risk of appearing to prove what is only too evident. Three representative, and therefore by no means extreme, products of the contemporary theatre will perhaps suffice. In Osborne's play A Patriot for Me, two semi-nude males embrace on the stage. In Picasso's play The Desideratrappe par la queue, a woman, aptly named Tart, squats in a urinating position on the stage while a soundtrack obligingly performs noises. In Genet's The Balcony, a man castrates himself. Now, all three artists, dramatists, would doubtless claim that men do embrace, that women do urinate, and that possibly unbalanced men do occasionally castrate themselves. They might also assert that nothing on the contemporary stage can equal in horror the blinding of Gloucester in King Lear. But it seems to me that there are objections to these arguments. Firstly, the blinding of Gloucester is by no means the whole of Lear, nor is Lear the whole of Shakespeare. Taking the Shakespeare canon as a whole, there is a balance of light and dark, of hope and despair, of sublimity and degradation in his work, qualities which are absent from much of modern literature. Secondly, over the centuries, the cumulative wisdom of society, which we are now so rapidly and unthinkingly jettisoning, but the cumulative wisdom of society decreed that if males must embrace, they do so in private. Urination was also deemed to be a private affair. And presumably, if a man must castrate himself, then he should do so in the privacy of his own house and not frighten the horses. In other words, the contemporary literary movement, while ostensibly bent on, quote, liberation, is in effect an attack on one of Western man's last and most cherished liberties, the liberty of privacy. The critic Anthony Lejeune asked recently if anyone really wants a society shaped by John Osborne for the delectation of Jimmy Porter, or plunged into lunacy by Harold Pinter, or peopled by the hideous imaginings of Genet or Beckett. He concludes that no one, including these writers, would wish to inhabit such a world. While Lejeune does emphasize the wide gap which exists between the abstract, theoretical world presented to the public by these dramatists and the world of reality, he appears to ignore the mania for iconoclasm, the mania for destruction, which permeates the modern arts, an iconoclasm closely linked to egalitarianism. After all, the surest way to achieve complete and absolute equality is to reduce all men and women to the same level, to deny their dignity, to stress their animalism, and to sneer at any form of idealism. Men and women are, superficially at least, most equal when copulating, masturbating, excreting, and urinating, and these are precisely the clinical aspects of human behavior that the contemporary avant-garde is battened on with a zeal formerly associated with the excesses of Puritanism. Indeed, what we are now witnessing, both in the arts and in society as a whole, is a new form of Puritanism. And inverted though it may be, it has the same totalitarian nature, allied to a lack of humor and balance, which has always characterized Puritanism. This new impuritanism has taken as part of its decalogue the following tenets. You must not honor your father and mother. Classic example of that, I thought, in yesterday's paper, when the young woman whom my colleague Edward Humes refers to as Citizeness Kane referred to her distraught parents as pigs. I remember so vividly on the campus at Kent State University, before that unfortunate campus achieved national notoriety, hearing Jerry Rubin tell a wildly cheering gathering to go home and kill their parents. Go back to my decalogue. These are the new musts. You must not honor your father and your mother. You must commit adultery, or if not married, fornicate like a ferret. You must covet, and you must steal. All this you must do in order to bring about a more just and equal society. In short, do as you're told, revolt. Now, it does seem to me that contemporary authors, playwrights, and poets find themselves under pressure, in a disconcerting dilemma. If they attempt to delineate an ideal, they run the risk, apart from not being published, of being accused of snobbery, of being anti-proletarian, illiberal, undemocratic, and in certain cases even racist. Accordingly, all but a dwindling minority have joined the ranks of iconoclasts, consoling themselves with the thought that they are allied to progress, and conveniently forgetting that the Gadarene swine could also have been described as progressing in certain directions. Ezra Pound, the late Ezra Pound, sadly expressed this dilemma when he wrote in a poem, Hugh Selwyn Moberly, "The age demanded an image of its accelerated grimace, something for the modern stage, not at any rate an attic grace." The danger to students, I think, is that contemporary ideas need to be weighed not against others of the same period, but against those of the past. And it is here that the average modern student is defenseless. He is, as I think most teachers would agree, rooted in temporal provincialism. Funny thing, you know, we're not provincial in the way our grandparents or great-grandparents were, when a 20-mile journey was an adventure. But we have instead exchanged mobility for a type of temporal provincialism rooted in what Shakespeare called the ignorant present. These students are indeed rooted in a temporal provincialism, their interests and leisure reading confined almost exclusively to the products of contemporary writers, filmmakers, and television pundits. The reader of contemporary literature, wrote Eliot, is not like the reader of the established great literature of all time, exposing himself to the influence of diverse and contradictory personalities. He is exposing himself to a mass movement of writers, who each of them think that they have something individually to offer, but are really all working together in the same direction. Even for the moment adopting an egalitarian viewpoint, are we quite certain that everyone is mentally and morally prepared for the works of Pinter, Genet, Sartre, and Beckett? The magical age of 18. Somehow there is a presumption that this confers adulthood. But any doctor will tell you, any psychologist, that some people never grow. We develop at different stages. Have we yet fully taken into account the social effects of not only television, but also the paperback revolution, which, coinciding with new concepts expounded by and intended for tough, well-balanced adult minds, brings only too often to an ever-increasing youthful readership a distorted because unbalanced picture of human life and human nature. The question isn't as simple as it was in the comparatively elitist society of John Stuart Mill's time. Remember the question Mill asked, would you rather be a discontented Socrates or a contented pig? Today one must seriously question the possibility of a third alternative, and that the net results of the contemporary arts may be a society consisting largely of semi-educated, psychologically disturbed human beings. Already countless thousands of the young are demonstrating through drug reliance and other forms of self-destructive escapism that they have lost what Teilhard de Chardin called that essential taste for life. Reviewing Trousered Apes in the London Sunday Telegraph a couple of years ago, Peregrine Wursthorn wrote as follows. When the Marquis de Sade originally pioneered the artist's exploration of the darker recesses of human depravity, he could at best hope to influence only a tiny fraction of his fellow citizens. His counterparts today, however, thanks to mass literacy and mass communications, can and do speak to all their messages of corruption, enjoying an ease of instant dissemination, an absence of contradiction, and the certainty of vulgarization that immediately transfers them from a minority cult to a mass craving. Of course, he concluded, the artist must be allowed to drive himself mad, but must he be allowed to drive us all mad? And now I come, I think, to the most important part arising from the foregoing. I don't, you see, believe that permissiveness can be contained. If a film producer, for example, can do his own thing with impunity, then does not the same unthinking, heedless ethic be applied to other areas of contemporary life? As C.S. Lewis writes, perhaps the greatest original mind, in terms of philosophy and theology at least, of the 20th century, in his book God in the Dock, though the right to happiness, he said, is chiefly claimed for the sexual impulse, it seems to me impossible that the matter should stay there. The fatal principle once allowed in that department must sooner or later seep through our whole lives. We thus advance towards a state of society in which not only each man, but every impulse in each man claims carte blanche. And then, though our technological skill may help us survive a little longer, our civilization will have died at heart, and will, one dare not even add unfortunately, be swept away. And to those who would object that certain passages in this lecture are reactionary, I would simply suggest that if one saw a blind man tottering precariously on the edge of a cliff, one's instinctive reaction would be to counsel him to remain immobile, and then to take a step backwards. Western society, blinded by its technological sophistication and neglectful of the things of the spirit, resembles in many ways just such a situation. If it proceeds on its present course, a course which has produced a society consisting of technological giants and moral pygmies, then the seeming inevitable end will be the extermination of the species, possibly with a whimper rather than a bang. Man does, however, differ from other species which have become extinct in that he possesses the conceptual ability, the power of thought, if he will only use it, to realize where he stands in relation to his past and to his problematical future. You see, great literature is that which over the centuries has sustained and elevated mankind. It represents a conquest by man over the diverse and bewildering complexities of his own nature and of the world surrounding him. It results in that clarification of life that momentary stay against confusion, which Robert Frost maintained was the true aim and purpose of poetry. Such art involves a prodigious effort and concentration on the part of its creator and demands a cultivated response from his audience. As such, it is exclusive, both in terms of those who create it and of those who can appreciate it. It therefore constitutes a minority culture and is therefore to be detested and feared by the majority of contemporary artists and writers with their egalitarian aims and allegiance reinforced by the financial rewards of catering to an undiscriminating mass market. If much of contemporary literature no longer supports the human spirit, if, on the contrary, it spreads despair, alienation, emptiness, and spiritual sterility, then it should be challenged, since it is contrary to the survival of the species. Man is more than a physical animal. He needs, among other things, and perhaps above all, hope to endure. The destruction of such hope and the dissemination of nihilism appear to be the message of the new Puritans, which is not simply the old Puritanism writ large, but springs from a barely concealed cultural, social, and individual death wish. Now this brings me to my final point in what seems to me the crux of the whole matter. And I hope you'll bear with me for just 5 minutes more. And that is the question, which may sound ludicrous, but I think is going to raise itself in the next decade, increasingly. Is man worth saving? After all, if he is, and I would include women in that category, if he is as destructive as ecologists say he is he not merely a messy, predatory mammal, and would not nature be far better off without him? In other words, no valid discussion of the hypothetical future of man can, in the last analysis, ignore the question of human value. If man is merely a naked ape, or a trousered ape, or a walking bag of seawater, as certain scientists choose to regard him, or a complex but predictable collection of reactions to various stimuli, as Dr. B.F. Skinner and other behaviorists assert, then apart from a sentimental, perhaps natural loyalty to one's own species, his disappearance from the scene would be of little importance in a biological sense and would have no real meaning or significance for any creature or thing other than man himself. Now, may I, in conclusion, offer another view of man? Most scientists agree that in the beginning there was a molten, fiery ball destined to become man's habitat, the Earth. Over countless millions of years, a cooling process took place, eventually leading to that state when waters covered the face of the deep. Through a process imperfectly understood, eventually tiny, single cells appeared in this water, and by a seemingly inexorable process, began to join and to complexify. This process of complexification, additivity, continued unabated until finally, quite miraculously it seems to me, appeared a creature capable of the rudiments of thought, ancestral man. In Teilhard's own words, thought was born. Now, since it is axiomatic that nothing can come from nothing, such thought must have been latent in that molten, fiery ball. To quote Teilhard again, in the world, nothing could ever burst forth as final across the different thresholds successively traversed by evolution, which has not already existed in an obscure and primordial way. The genesis of such thought, however, remains the greatest mystery of them all, a miracle far transcending any other performed on this earth. A materialist may suggest that what I'm talking about here, this thought, is simply a highly complex interchange or interaction of electrical impulses. But this in no way reduces the mystery. It is what I am using now to frame these sentences, and it is what all of you are using at this moment to conceptualize my thoughts back into your mind. And it doesn't greatly matter, it seems to me, whether we style that process thought or not. It would appear that eventually either to refuse or to accept the fact that this mystery exists may be a matter of temperament and will. In other words, what William James called a decision for our passional natures as opposed to a logical preference. Teilhard again points out that man is physically so much an animal, so little separable anatomically from the anthropoids, that the modern classifications made by zoologists include him with them in the same superfamily, the hominidae. Yet he is a being filled with qualities which set him quite dramatically apart from all other creatures. He alone has developed the capacity for sympathy and empathy, the ability to communicate abstract ideas and theories, to delight in small creatures, such as puppies or kittens, which would be merely prey to most other carnivores. Man alone can appreciate a sunset or a sonnet. To frame laws that regulate social intercourse and forbid violence, theft and murder. He has evolved mathematical formulae and stepped on the surface of the moon. His powers of invention have produced telescopes capable of detecting stars and nebulae so distant that his lagging imagination can only conceive of them in light years. Microscopes which reveal a world so infinitely small that he has to fall back on metaphoric language to describe it. All this is the product of his thought processes, latent in that molten fiery ball. So far as we know, man is the sole custodian of conceptual thought in the universe. And this surely confers upon him a responsibility and a very, very special sort of dignity. The responsibility, if truly comprehended, truly understood, demands that his thoughts and actions measure up to the uniqueness of his position, exercising the consequent power which he enjoys in a benevolent fashion, and recognizing that any enhancement of his own life or enlargement of his material aspirations, if immoderately obtained, at the expense of other forms of life, are defeating not only of self, but ultimately of his evolutionary mission. Great dangers, wrote William McNeill in The Rise of the West, great dangers alone produce great victories, and without the possibility of failure, all human achievement would be savourless. Our world assuredly lacks neither dangers nor the possibility of failure. It also offers a theatre for heroism, such as has seldom or never before been seen in all history. Civilization may, as Toynbee suggests, be in its 11th hour, but it's still not too late. Providing informed and concerned persons, and especially those engaged in the education of the young, resolve to declare a moratorium on pettiness, factionalism, and ideological differences, and unite in what is surely the greatest and most urgent cause of all, the preservation of thought and its sole custodian, man. Concluding his remarkable television series, Civilization, Kenneth Clark gave this personal credo with which I'd like to end this evening. I hold a number of beliefs, he said, that have been repudiated by the liveliest intellects of our time. I believe that order is better than chaos, forgiveness to vendetta. On the whole, I think that knowledge is better than ignorance, and I am sure that human sympathy is better than ideology. I believe that in spite of the recent triumphs of science, men haven't changed much in the last 2,000 years, and in consequence, we must still try to learn from history. Above all, I believe in the God-given genius of certain individuals, and I value a society that makes their existence a possibility. Thank you very much.
How fast can I bump into you? I go around. Was he in a...